Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on lies my teacher told me right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and our Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It is not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The wealth is in sales. It isn't in public business, and it isn't in jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that you cash in on your inheritance and learn how to collect those benefits of the old covenant, that old covenant contract, and to collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. And that's called property. Instead of or in place of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on our CD Home School for Adults? That's our business school. And while you're at it, why don't you just order our free General Law CD package at the same time? That CD package is free. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and remember, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we've been reviewing the book Lies My Teacher Told Me. Remember, that book now is published in 1995. The guy that wrote it, James W. Loewen, he's a history professor. And his concern was that high school students, when they come into college, are totally ignorant as to the real facts of history. And in fact, my observation over the years is that college graduates, people that have letters after their name, seem to be abysmally ignorant about history as well. We're ignorant about the Ten Commandments and the story at Mount Sinai and the biblical histories. And we've been taught that the Bible is full of errors and it's not reliable anyway. And so any historical event that you see in the Bible is automatically discounted, and we go to some history book. And this fellow Loewen is pointing out that the history books are filled with errors and omissions. Errors, that is, they just plain lie to you, and omissions. That is, we know the truth, but we're not going to tell you. So if you wanted to know the truth about history, you know, American history or American Indian history or, you know, the story of Texas or the story of Columbus and so on, we've been reviewing a few of these, you'd have to go to other sources, historical sources, but not the textbooks that you were spoon-fed when you went to high school and college. So college textbooks are filled with errors also, but they hold a lot more truth that they didn't tell you in high school. But they don't tell you the whole story either. So I thought, well, now isn't that just real special? Thought I'd reveal that to you. It's just bring it to your attention, you know, and then go from there. Now, there's another source of information that I went to the other day, and there's an article came out from KITCO. That's KITCO, so if you're looking for the article, you go to www.kitco.com, and then you scroll down till you come up to a guy by the name of Schoon, S-C-H-O-O-N. His name is Daryl Robert Schoon, and he has a web page. Now, he's an economist, and he has a web page, and it's called www.drschoon.com, all one word, just D-R, that's his initials, Daryl Robert Schoon, so you go drschoon.com, then you'll come up to his website. And he published an article, and the article is entitled, "The Killers Are With the Patient." And it reminded me of the medical doctors, you know, you go to the medical doctor because you're sick. And now you're in the hands of a killer, and these medical doctors kill about 300,000 people a year, you know, in the hospital. And they don't do it directly, or I don't think they're doing it intentionally, but just the way the system is set up, it ultimately ends that way. And so medical doctors kill about 300,000 people a year that don't need killing. They wouldn't die if they hadn't gone to the medical doctor, or they wouldn't have died if the medical doctor had been competent and knew what the hell he was doing. But, you know, everybody has to practice on somebody to learn how to become proficient at their profession. Schoon is an economist, and he's writing about the bailout, and he brought up the subject of paper money. Now, here's a historical fact from the Bible. Let's start off with this historical fact, and then let's take a look at history and see if this fact is borne out by history. You'll find it twice in the scripture. It's in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16. It's actually a law. It's a statute, and it says, "You shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag." That's paraphrased, you know, it's worded a little bit differently than that, but the bottom line is, it says, "Thou shalt not deal in stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments and mortgages and commercial paper and all this paper trash that's out here." Now, if you're like me and you went to public school, if you've been institutionalized like I was, for 12 years, then you're very familiar with paper money. In fact, you carry a billfold. You don't carry a purse. See, that's for girlies. Girlies carry purses. Boys, real men, they carry wallets. And their wallets contain paper money. That's the way you carry paper money. Now, in the old days, men used to carry purses, and in their purses, they had gold and silver coins. Gold and silver coins. In fact, our Constitution here in the United States, and I imagine the rest of you Anglo-Saxons out there do the same thing, you probably have a provision in your Constitution that provides for gold and silver coin. The British, you know, used to have British sovereigns and pounds sterling and things like that. That meant that they had real gold and real silver money. Canadians to this day have gold and silver money. Australians, you Aussies down there, you have gold and silver money. We Americans have gold and silver. We don't use it. Well, not very many people use it. The vast majority of the people of America, 95%, do not own any gold or silver. All of the gold and silver in the United States of America is owned by 5% of the people. So 5% know what it's for. The other 95% don't have a clue. Now, this gold and silver money was very important in the laws of Moses, the law of God. It's the basis of what we used to call a sound economy. Sound economy. And well, for some reason, if you know, you had a sound economy, and then for some reason somebody came up with the idea, we want to have an unsound economy. I was in 1913 here in this country, and it's called the Central Bank, the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto. The tenth plank calls for free education for all children in public school. That's so that we can teach those children to use that central bank, which puts out unjust weights and balances called paper money. Now, you know, if you're an average Joe Sixpack listening to this, you're sitting there shaking your head saying, where did this guy come? Where did this Neanderthal come from anyway? Well, you know, bear with me and, you know, pat me on my little pointed head and be condescending. You know, I'm out of touch with reality, and I really don't know what I'm talking about, and I'm coming from the barbaric past. Barbaric, they call gold a barbaric relic. Barbaric relic, that's what they call gold. That's what the bankers call gold. Now, most people, when you talk about gold and silver, their eyes just glaze over like, huh, where's this guy come from? But it used to be in this country that was the money of account, that everybody used gold and silver coin. And we have been weaned away from that. Well, Daryl Shoon now put out an article. It's about 6 pages. And then he goes back in the history of paper money. And I thought I'd share that with you because it's one of the lies that our teachers told us. When I went to school, the lie that the teachers told us was that your money in the bank now is safe because it's guaranteed by FDIC. Well, have you been watching these bank failures? Okay. Did you pick up on that piece where the FDIC went to the Treasury to get more money because they're going broke? See, the FDIC is an insurance company that insures your bank deposits up to $100,000 here in the United States. Now, the question arises, in the event of a bank failure, who's going to cover those deposits? And the answer is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. What happens if Bank of America goes upside down? Well, Bank of America is one of the big banks, and if any of the big banks goes upside down, there's not enough money in FDIC to cover those deposits. And the banks do not have those deposits in their account. See, the theory runs like this. You deposit your $100,000 in the bank. The bank then in turn lends that money out to businesses and other people to buy houses and things like that. So the bank actually doesn't have your $100,000 in a pile sitting over here in a box back in the vault. What they have is a mortgage or some other security over here that supports or guarantees that deposit that you put in the bank. Now, this is a naive belief. If you believe that, you know, you're really out of touch with reality. But anyway, that's the theory behind the program. The reality of the program is that, yes, it is true that you have some money on deposit, but the money on deposit is a small fraction, about 5% of the total money that the bank has lent out. See, the bank goes to the federal government. Actually, it's not the government. It's the Federal Reserve System that we believe is the federal government. So issuing your money under Article 1, Section 10, but they're really not. And these are lies, you know, that you learned in school. But nevertheless, you know, this is the theory behind it. So they go to the Federal Reserve and they borrow money at what they call the discount window. And this discount window is where the bank goes to borrow money at 2% and lend it to you for 10%. You know, now where does the Federal Reserve get the money? Well, they just create it right out of thin air. They just make it. You want $1 billion? Right now, as I speak, they're negotiating a deal here in Congress here for $700 billion to bail out all these bad loans that the banks made. All right, so they're gonna pass this law. They're going to create this law, and they're just going to create the $700 billion. Is that inflationary? You know, welcome, Banana Republic America. That's where this is headed. But the average Joe Sixpack, see, he went to public school, and he really isn't too familiar with the concepts of economics. He thinks he is. I mean, hell, maybe he's even got a degree from the college in business administration. He thinks he's a pretty savvy kid, you know. he got straight A's in business administration. Now he's going to go out into the business world. And he actually believes the lies that the teacher told him about economics. So I thought, well, let's take a look at the other side of the coin. You know, let's take a look at historically what happens when countries use paper money, or when they go off gold and silver and they start using paper money. What was the first country in history to ever try that? How did it work out? When the Bank of England issued paper money back in World War I days, you know, to finance World War I, how'd that work out for you Englishmen over there? When the Chinese have done it, the Russians, the Germans, you know, other people in the world, have they ever experimented with paper money so that we Americans, you know, could take a look at it and see how it came out? And the answer is, you bet. You bet. It goes back a long time. The killers are with the patient, and the bankers are with the patient, and the patient is the American economy. And the bankers are working with the Congress now to solve their problem. And their problem is they're broke, and they want you to fix it. So the bankers now, this is in the form or in the guise of Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and then our Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson. They've gone to Congress. And what they're saying to the Congress is that we need $700 billion to bail out these banks. They're not calling it a bailout. That's a politically incorrect term. But to solve this financial crisis. So the banks went out and made a lot of bad loans. And then the loans went bad, and so now they're upside down, so they want you and me to come in here and buy up these bad loans. I don't know. I don't know if that makes any sense to you. It didn't make any sense to me, but I can understand the logic behind it. I mean, hell, if I had some bad loans, I'd want to go get rid of those too. I'd be looking for a sugar daddy that would bail me out. And that's what the bankers are doing. I don't know why. The Congress is going to buy into this program. I think it's because the Congress is bought and paid for by the bankers. And I think they'll pass whatever laws the bankers want passed. And they'll just stick it up your you-know-what sideways. But anyway, listen to the story here. It's really interesting and very, very informative. And he starts off by saying, there's nothing more dangerous than those responsible for the nation's troubles are believed to be its savior. The Wall Street Journal had one fact correct regarding Wall Street's accelerating collapse. On September 20th, the Wall Street Journal wrote this, quote, "When government officials surveyed the failing American financial system this week, they didn't see only a collapsed investment bank or the surrender of a giant insurance firm. They saw the circulatory system of the U.S. economy, credit markets, starting to fail." So it's not just the banks that are failing. It's the economy, the credit markets. It's the stock market. It's the commodities markets. They're failing. Now, that's pretty significant. See, in 1929, the markets didn't fail. The economy didn't fail. The stock market failed. The credit bubble, the stock market bubble, failed. And in 1929, we didn't have any of the problems that we've got today. Our national debt wasn't $10 trillion. There was a national debt, but it was relatively minor. Americans were not strung out on credit card debt. Americans were not upside down on their mortgages, on their homes, like we are today. And so the credit markets themselves, that is the stock market and all of the commodities markets, they're all failing at the same time. All of the banks are failing at the same time. The national government is in debt. All of your state and local governments in debt. You are in debt. So these massive debts over here can't be serviced anymore. You know, we just reached a point where they can't be serviced. Now, the Wall Street Journal was correct in that the circulatory system of the U.S. economy was failing because the Wall Street Journal is the house organ of Wall Street investment banks and their co-conspirators in government. The Wall Street Journal blamed deteriorating credit markets for America's troubles. They did not blame those who were actually responsible, to wit, Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Henry Paulson, and their cohorts at the Federal Reserve banks. Now, this is something new for most of you. You know, listening now, you'd say, well, wait a minute. It can't be our economy. It can't be our banking system. It can't be our Federal Reserve Bank that is the cause of this credit crisis. It has to be extraneous forces beyond our control. You know, happenstance. We were walking down the street with our mouth open and a germ flew in our mouth, and that's why I've got polio, or that's why I've got this Lou Gehrig's disease. See, it's never our fault. It isn't anything that you and I do or contribute to. You know, when things go bad, it's somebody else's fault. When things are going right, it's our brilliance. When things go wrong, it's somebody else that did it. It's not us. That's just human nature. That's the way people are. Now, Alan Greenspan has a bastard son. His name is Ben Bernanke. And Ben Bernanke, Alan Greenspan's surrogate successor at the Federal Reserve, is using Greenspan's discredited playbook to hopefully resuscitate America's economy. But pouring more credit into America's stalled economy will not restart the U.S. economy any more than pouring gasoline into a flooded engine will restart that engine. Excessive credit caused the problem, and more credit will only exacerbate that problem. And the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, however, is now backed into a corner, and it's a corner from which there is no exit. So, the American people, when you poll them right now today, will say, we have confidence in America. We have confidence in the American economy. That over the long haul, it will come back. Well, it always has in the past. Well, in the recent past. In the recent past. But again, Americans do not have a view of history that goes back more than 50 or 75 years. I don't know why that is. I'm not here to criticize. I'm just here to report. And if you take a look at history, the history of paper money, and you go back to the 12th century where it first started in China, and you come forward and you look at where paper money has been used in Romania, Hungary, Germany, China, the United States, England, Russia, it has always failed every single time. There is no successful paper money story in the history of mankind. Let me repeat that. There is no successful paper money history in the history of mankind going back to the 12th century. Now, we all have paper money, and everybody in the world uses it. You people in Japan use paper money. You people in Brazil, Argentina, Uganda, and South Africa. Hell, you're all using paper money. But paper money has one ultimate outcome. And the ultimate outcome is the loss of all of your assets. All of you people that deal in paper money are, in the end, going to lose all of your assets. And the paper money is used as the vehicle by which we transfer your assets into stronger hands. Now, it is true that paper money is popular, and it is true that paper money really works, and it works well. And it gives us what we want. It's like heroin. Paper money works just like heroin. It works. It feels real good. And everybody wants it. What we don't want is the end result. None of us want the end result of heroin use. But we really like heroin and we really want to use it. So, some of us who look at history and look at heroin use, I looked at it years ago, and I was in the hospital, and a doctor, his name was Sansoni, Dr. Sansoni, came up to me, and I had an operation, and when he got through, he said, "Now we're giving you morphine to keep the pain down, keep the pain in check." And he said, "You're going to like this morphine stuff. It's real good." And we turn out heroin addicts here in the hospital. He said, "If you want to know where people get their heroin addiction, they get it from the hospital." See, none of you people have ever gone out and said, "Gee, I think I'll try some heroin today. I just don't know what it's like, so I think I'll just go try some." No, you went to the hospital and you had morphine, and the morphine felt real good. And then you went out and said, "Gee, that morphine feels so real good. I wonder if I can find some heroin because I like that." So when he told me that, he said, "Now, all of the heroin addicts come out of the hospitals, and they learned their heroin addiction from morphine in the hospital." And he said, "Now, I don't know if you want to become a heroin addict, but if you keep telling us that the pain is bad, we'll keep giving you more morphine, and the more morphine we give you, the more addicting it becomes, and pretty soon you'll become a heroin addict. And then you'll either have to break the habit or become a heroin junkie." And so with that warning, I said, "I think maybe I can take a little more pain." And so I just took a little pain, and I got off the morphine. But that isn't the way it is with paper money. You know, I was taught paper money when I was a child. Paper money was in full bloom, you know, when I was a kid. It's been around since the U.S. National Bank was opened in 1794. See, we abolished paper money with our constitutional provision at Article 1, Section 10. We did that in 1787. And then in 1794, about 7 or 8 years later, we reintroduced the use of paper money. That's how addicting it is. Now, we tried that paper money in the colonial period from 1694 through 1752 or 54. And then from 1754 to 1783 when it finally collapsed. And we learned our lesson, and the average loss at that time was 90%. 90%. Now, there are people that make money with paper money, and those people are called bankers. Bankers. Government makes money. Government prospers on paper money. Banks, insurance companies, and other big businesses, they prosper on paper money, and they're the people that want it. And they come out here in the marketplace and they sell it to people like us. And we have always bought it in the past. So I was asked the other day, "Do you think the Congress is going to pass this bailout for the banks?" And I said, "Absolutely. No doubt in my mind. They have always done it in the past. Congress has always, without fail, come to the rescue of the bankers because they own the Congress. There's only one time in the history of the United States when the bankers got shut out. That was in 1836 when President Andrew Jackson refused to sign the law into a law. He vetoed it. He vetoed the U.S. National Bank in 1836. And so from 1836 to 1863, the bankers were out of business. And Jackson called them a den of vipers. Now, our president, George Bush, came to us the other night on TV, and he said, "We need this. We need the support of the American people. We need this rescue package because our economy is in trouble." Boys and girls, I want to tell you that George Gordon's economy is in no trouble whatsoever. I don't need any bailout. Don't do it for me. Don't indebt yourself $700 billion on my account. Now, Americans were polled the other day, and a third of them were for it, a third of them were against it, and a third of them didn't know what the hell was going on, which is just about historically correct. One-third of them bought the program that the bankers are putting out. They're succumbing to fear. One-third are opposed to it. Now, those people are politically and economically savvy. And then one-third of them don't know what the hell is going on. So what it means is that two-thirds of the people are going to approve it over the objection of the one-third that actually know that it's a bad policy. Now, I'm not here to take sides one way or the other. I'm just here as a reporter. I'm going to give you some information. You can make your own decision. But it's going to be done whether you like it or not. And then when we get through, I'll tell you what I did. See, I don't want to participate in this bailout program for the bankers, and so I'm going to sit on the sidelines. I'm going to withdraw. I'm a Neanderthal savage, and I'm politically unsavvy. I don't grasp the great opportunity that's being presented here by the banking community. So what I'm going to do, because of my ignorance and my foolishness and stupidity, I'm going to sit on the sidelines and watch while all the rest of you American taxpayers cut a fat hog in the back and build a golden parachute for yourself and buy all of this, buy all of these failed mortgages, all of this failed paper, all these failed credit card accounts, and watch you people get rich while I sit on the sidelines in my poverty and in my stupidity. I'm going to watch you people. And then when we get to the end of this experiment over here, we're going to measure this up. I'm going to measure it up and see if this is one more failed paper experiment, just like all the failed paper experiments in the past, or if this is the first time in history when people actually printed money and made themselves rich. All right. Now, with that much in mind, let me give you a reminder here before we continue that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in more than 120 countries daily worldwide over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. For your listening convenience, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements and recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political. They could be religious or economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. However, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear in this program, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about lies my teacher told me. And if you went to school like I did, probably told you that paper money is a good thing and that the FDIC is there to bail you out. That is, if the bank fails, you can rely upon your government, FDIC, and they're going to pay you for your insured account. Now, there's a credit crisis as I speak. Congress is about to enact legislation like they did in 1836 to recharter this paper money system. They're trying desperately here to save this economy. Now, in historical times, it's never been done. Economies have always gone upside down using paper money, and as a result of that, the people lose their assets. People lose their homes and businesses and cars and their savings and retirement funds, and that's in the process right now. So if you have a mortgage on your house, or if you have a 401k or a car and you're making payments on it, you're going to lose all of it. So that's the reality of it. And when you get wiped out, you're going to blame somebody. You're going to blame the stock market, or blame God, or blame George Bush, or blame the Republicans or the Democrats. I mean, it'll never be your fault. You will never say, well, I guess I got what was coming to me. I guess I got what everybody else that's ever used paper money got, and that is the loss of all of their assets, or most of them, you know. So, you know, join the club, sit back and relax. That's very normal, very natural. In the last Great Depression, everybody blamed Herbert Hoover. He had nothing to do with it, nothing at all. He didn't help anything. He didn't solve anybody's problem. But then he couldn't have solved their problem anyway, because the problem was over paper money. So the bankers successfully blamed Herbert Hoover and the Republicans for something that they did. That was the Federal Reserve Bank did it. And as a result of that, they got away with their crime. And so this time won't be any different. It's always been that way in the past. I don't see any reason to change it now. The bankers who caused the problem are now coming to us and saying, okay, it's not our fault. And we've got the solution. This is the perfect Hegelian dialectic. This is where the guy comes along and he creates this problem. He's already got the solution scoped out. So he creates this problem, then comes to you and he says, hey, see this problem over here? I've got the solution. Follow me. Now, of course, you don't know that he caused the problem. And, of course, they don't want you to know that. Now, most Americans today know that the banks caused these problems, and they're still going to go along with this bailout because it's the only solution that they can think of. I thought of another solution. I figured what you do is you come in and we need some legislation to solve this problem. Here's what I would propose. The legislation is to abolish the Federal Reserve. You abolish your central bank and put the powers of the coinage and the issuing of money into the hands of the Treasury. All right? Then you let all the banks, bankers, and stock market, and all the people that bought into all this paper money take their losses. That's because they're the ones that created the losses. I mean, after all, Bob, Sue, Sally, John, you're the one that signed the mortgage with the bank. I didn't. You did. And so you should take your lumps. You're the one that bought those stocks and bonds. You're the one that violated those statutes in the Bible. You're the one that went out and agreed to pay usury and interest and bought stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments and got enmeshed in paper, and you ought to take the loss. And then when you've taken your loss, taken your lumps, which is your just deserts for having broken that law, then we can get back to coining gold and silver money and putting that into circulation. And then in 36 months, the Depression will be over. That's what happened the last time we tried that. You see, our founding fathers went through an economic collapse in 1783, and it drug on until 1787. And then the Continental Congress at the Constitutional Convention created a constitution. They put Article 1, Section 10 in, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin, a tender in payment of debt, into our constitution at Article 1, Section 10. George Washington, 36 months later now, this is in 1791, wrote a letter to one of his cohorts, and he said, I can't believe the positive reaction of our economy to the gold and silver that's been put into circulation. See, George Washington had been using paper money most of his life. You know, it's just like it is today. Everybody was raised on paper money in the colonial period. And, of course, it collapsed in 1754, and then it was revived, and it collapsed again in 1783. Every one of the colonies tested paper money, and every time they did, it collapsed. And everybody took a 90% loss, every time, without fail. 13 colonies, 13 failures, twice, between 1694 and 1754, and then 1754 to 1783. Hell, we Americans didn't test it once, we tested it twice, failed both times. You didn't learn that in public school. That's the more lies your teacher told you to rely on the paper money and the FDIC. And that's what people are doing today. They have confidence in the economy, have confidence in America, have confidence in our government. They have confidence in Wall Street, stocks and bonds. Okay, stick with it. But it's going to fail. It's always failed in the past. And when it fails this time, and when you get burned this time, remember, you were told, don't use unjust weights and balances. I don't think your preacher told you about Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, or Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. I don't think he told you about thou shalt not steal and the Ten Commandment model. But whether he told you or not, you're going to have an opportunity now to experience it. You can reinvent the wheel yourself, personally, with your own mortgage, with your own paper on your car, with your own 401k, with your own stocks and your own bonds. Each and every one of us who has indulged in these paper unjust weights and balances is going to have an opportunity to learn firsthand, live and direct. As I always told my subordinates, I said, bring a bucket of that in here and let's get into it up to our elbows, squish it through our fingers so that we can see how this thing works. And every American's going to have that opportunity. And then, unfortunately, all you Chinese and all of you Koreans and Japanese and Brazilians and everybody else in the world is going to have an opportunity to experience this Great Depression, this hyperinflation number one, and then the Great Deflation number two. Now, there's a solution, and we used that solution in our country twice. We used it in 1787. And we used it in 1836, and both times it just worked like a shot. In America, when we use gold and silver coin, we become wealthy, powerful, and prosperous. And when we use paper money, we lose our ass every time without fail. And I don't see any reason why this economic crisis today, it's called a crisis here now, is going to be any different. Now, Shun goes on and he points out that excessive credit has caused the problem, and more credit will only exacerbate that problem. The U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, however, is now backed into a corner. It's a corner from which there is no exit. I'm going to underline that. Okay, that's the second time I've told you. And we're in a corner here, boys and girls. It's like we've been in the past. There isn't any exit out of this corner. Now, after credit markets contracted in August of 2007, it was hoped that the central bank intervention would reverse the deterioration of global markets that was then only beginning. A year ago, on October the 1st, 2007, I addressed that hope in my article, The Winter of Our Discontent. So this fellow Shun wrote an article in October, on October 1st, 2007. And he pointed out that as we collectively move towards the economic disaster awaiting us, the investment community is hoping that the world central banks will be able to save them from the crisis set in motion by this summer's credit collapse in August of 2007. So I'm going to underline that August 2007, just like October 1929 was the catalyst that launched us into the Great Depression of the 1930s. August of 2007, with the credit collapse, is the seminal point, the moment of truth when the Great Depression of the 21st century began. And we're now in it for 1 year, as I speak. And it will take us, historically now, just looking at history, it takes about 3.5 years from that seminal moment, whatever it happens to be, until you reach the bottom. So from October of 1929 until March of 1933 was that period of time. So if you take August of 2007 to August of 2008, that's one. To August of 2009, that's two. To August of 2010, that's three. To about January of 2011. We should hit bottom about January or so of 2011. Now, once we reached the bottom in March of 1933, there were peaks and valleys. The stock market would go up. And then all of our leaders said, oh, see, we've reached the bottom, and now we're on our way up. And then it would spike down. And then everybody would lament. And then it would spike up. And then it would spike down. And then it would spike up. And it would spike down. All right, so it drug along like that until September of 1937. So from March of 1933 until September of 1937, of the economy of the United States went up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. And there were bright spots and hopeful signs, and then there were bitter disappointments, and oh my God, will this ever end? And it was exacerbated by the Dust Bowl period, bad weather upsets. Kind of what we're seeing here with Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Ike. Bad weather is spiking us all at the same time. Okay. That's why I tell my students, I say, it looks like to me that God himself is intervening in this process, this program. Now, in September of 1937, we can look back historically. At the time, nobody could, but, you know, looking back 50, 75 years, we can look back and say, well, in September of 37, it started to turn up. And there's a continual up cycle, you know, when you draw this out on a graph, until December of 1941. It was growing slowly. The economy was growing. We're pulling out of this, but it's very slow. The Great Depression of the 1930s ended on December 7th, 1941, here in America. Just ended. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, everybody went to work. And that was the seminal moment. All right? Now, right now, your government is working as hard as they can to generate a war in Georgia and Kosovo. Dick Cheney has just come back from Georgia, promising more military aid in the encirclement of the former Soviet Union, the encirclement of Russia. And they're working their hearts out, trying to get a reaction from the Iranians or the Russians over Georgia or the Russians over Kosovo. Ladies and gentlemen, we need a war, a big one, just like World War II, in order to bail the world's economy out. I think there's a better way, but, you know, this has been the history of the world. When the world goes into economic turmoil, war is the solution. World War I was the solution. World War II was the solution. Now, I don't see any reason why we're going to change a winning format. It's always worked in the past. That's what we've done in the past. And there's little doubt in my mind that's what we're going to do in the future. So as this economic collapse exacerbates the world's economy, just beats it down, the Chinese are going to recognize we need war. The Russians are going to recognize we need war. The Americans already know that. And so war will be the result. I suspect we're going to have World War III, probably nuclear bomb war. We see this in Bible prophecy, and I think, just my observations here, that this is leading up to this great battle of Armageddon over here in Palestine. Be right there among all of you Jews, 35 miles northwest of Jerusalem. You're going to see the mother of all battles, guaranteed by God Almighty himself, called the Battle of Armageddon. Now, I think that's where we're headed. Now, this fellow Shoon, remember, this is Daryl Robert Shoon, and you can go to his website. It's drshoon.com. It's easy enough. Or you can go to Kitco. If you want this article, you can go to kitco.com. And then just dial in Dr. Shoon and see if you can pull up the article, The Killers Are With the Patient. Now, the patient is you and I. You know, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. We are the economy. It's you and I buying, selling, and trading that makes what we call the economy. The bankers came in and said, well, don't you think you ought to do your buying, selling, and trading with our paper money? And we said, well, that's a wonderful idea. We think that's pretty good. So we use their paper money, and we buy their mortgages, and we pay them their interest, and everything goes along fine. They get filthy rich, and they have golden parachutes. This guy, Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, he used to be the CEO of Goldman Sachs. He's worth about $600 million. Now, that's 6/10 of a billion. That's a bunch of money. $600 million. You can rest assured that Henry's got his money invested in commodities and gold and silver, and he's out of the stock market. You can rest assured. All the insiders, you know, those are people that are in the know. Those are people that know how to preserve their wealth at the expense of the peons down here at the bottom of the barrel, the bottom feeders. So don't be concerned now. Don't worry your pretty little head off now about Henry Kissinger and George Bush and Ben Bernanke or Henry Paulson or Warren Buffett or Bill Gates. All of those insiders, all those Illuminists have already taken care of themselves. All of their billions of dollars and their golden parachutes are all in place. Everything's ready. And now they're going to shift all of their liabilities off onto you. Now that they've raped you, robbed you, and pillaged you, and taken all of your wealth, now they're going to shift the debt off onto you and ride off into the sunset, free and clear, with all of your wealth. Now that's been the history of it. That's what they've always done in the past. It's never failed. I can't point to one place in history where the bankers have not ridden off into the sunset on the backs of the peons who lost it all, every single time. And they used the vehicle of paper money to do it every single time, and your God has told you over and over and over and over ad nauseum, don't do that. And you've never listened in the past, you are not listening now, and there is no reason to believe that you're going to listen in the future. But I thought I'd tell you anyway, just for the academics of it. All right, now August of 2007 then is the beginning point of this economic meltdown. Now with that much in mind, if the truth be known, and someday it will be, central banks are at the very center of today's problems. And that's because the central banks caused this economic collapse. Today's disintegration of capital markets based on debt-based paper began in 1913 with the creation of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, the Central Bank of the United States. And that occurred on December the 24th, 1913. So if you're looking for a date in history, write this down in your notes. It was 12/24/13, nearly 100 years ago. And that sowed the seeds of the demise of America. It sowed the seeds of the credit collapse of August of 2007. Now, we benefited from it. I'm not denying that. I mean, hell, paper money, it's great. God, everybody loves it. Why does everybody love it? Because it produces all these great benefits. You know, when somebody sticks a credit card in your hand for $10,000 and says, go out and spend and have a good time, my God, that's like a shot of heroin. That just feels real good. You're going to love that one. So you go out and you start spending. And you buy all these neat things with this credit card. And the payments are so easy. You know, all you got to do is pay them 10%. And so you're paying on the credit card, and things are going along good, and you got a job, and you know you're able to meet the payments, and you've enjoyed all these goods, and pretty soon the guy comes back and says, "Geez, we need to up your credit limit. You know, you're really doing well. We're looking at your balance sheet. You should have a $25,000 credit card and a mortgage and a bigger, better house. Boy, that feels even better. If you thought the first $10,000 felt good, God, wait until you get the $25,000 card. And so you're out spending on the $25,000 card. You move into the bigger, better house. You move up the economic ladder. Now you're a manager in this company. You're making more money than you ever made in your life. God, that feels good. And some guy comes along and says, Jesus, you need a bigger, better house, and you need a bigger, better line of credit. And so this just goes on and on and on. Okay. Now, as time progresses along, and you and your neighbors and everybody else are getting bigger and better jobs and so on, well, pretty soon your wages are growing in one thing and another, and everything is just copacetic. And then one day you find out that you've priced yourself out of the market and that there's other people out there that will do your job cheaper than you. You know, now here comes competition. And then this competition comes in. Well, we have to meet this competition. And then more time goes by. And then pretty soon we can't service the debt. And that's where we're at today. Okay? And so now we have a contraction. Now, this is the part that doesn't feel good at all. It's the inevitable results of paper money and artificial expansion, but you know, that's the way it is. We like it, and so we're going to go do it. We've always done it in the past, and I suspect we'll continue doing it in the future. But somebody ought to tell you, well, here's what caused it. See, in the final analysis, a guy walks up to you and says, hey, would you like to have some heroin? Yeah, let me try it. Now, what you should do is you should say, well, wait a minute, this stuff is highly addictive. No, I don't think I want to try it. I don't think I want to stay away from it. It's kind of like a whore, you know. She feels real good, but it would be better if you just stayed the hell away from her. You know, it's the way life is. And so we go down to the whorehouse and we get a dose of clap. You know, well, God, that's the downside of all the fun we had on Friday night. You know, you went out to the bar and you drank a little too much, maybe a whole bunch too much. You know, moderation is a virtue. And, you know, most people can't handle things in moderation. They can't smoke, they can't drink, and they can't take women in moderation. They got to go whole hog, you know. If a little bit's good, you know, a whole lot's got to be better. And so we get off on these tangents, and this is where we're at. We're on an economic tangent, and this thing's coming to an end here. Now, in the beginning, you know, this debt-based paper has led nations and the world down a very dangerous path, facilitating expansion by encumbering future revenues with compounding debt. That's the key. It's called compounding debt. It grows 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. It's not growing arithmetically. And inevitably, it indebts individuals, businesses, and governments beyond their ability to pay. Every single time. That's why usury is prohibited in the Bible. And that's because it grows geometrically. It multiplies. Now, at the beginning, 1, 2, 4, 8 doesn't hurt. But by the time you take a penny and you multiply that geometrically 32 times, it's $40 million. Now, you can handle 1, 2, 4, 8, 16 pennies, but by the time that thing gets out 40 times, doubled, it's $40 million, and that's what you can't handle, and that's where we're at. And that's why the Federal Reserve is in a corner, and they're not going to get out. Geometric progression has now enveloped our economy worldwide. Yeah, I'm about out of time here, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll take it up again tomorrow night, and we'll talk about this thing of the economy and the lies our teachers told us. Meanwhile, you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, all of these law hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the law hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.